Luke chapter 19, and we're going to start at verse 1. Luke is writing. He says, he being Jesus, he entered Jericho and was passing through, and there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. And he was seeking to see Jesus, see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was small of stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. So he hurried and came down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all grumbled. He has gone in to be the guest of a man who is a sinner. And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. And Jesus said to him, Today, salvation has come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. We ask that you would give a blessing to the reading, hearing, and doing of your word, because you are holy and sovereign and work through us, God. Amen. About a year and a half ago, I received a phone call because there was a political clamoring going on a specific issue that I'm not going to go into today, but there was a specific political issue that came from the very top down, and because of that, people were asking churches to give a comment, to give a statement regarding what the political statement, the political issue was. And for reasons that I do not to this day understand, we received a phone call, which is odd to me because I'm always fascinated by the fact that people even know that we exist. And then I was really taken aback by this because at the time we were only about 6 or 7 months old. So we received a phone call from an ABC correspondent. And he asked if you have, he says, do you have a comment from the pastor's perspective regarding this moral issue that's being discussed among politicians right now? And my response to that was, let me call you back. So I have a mentor in Arkansas who told me, his name is Bill Wellens. He said, very few decisions need to be made right now. And so in that moment, I was blessing God for giving me Bill, because Brandon, prior to meeting Bill, would have said, I know what I want to do, and I'm going to do it right now. So that moment, I said, I need to pause and hear from God on this issue before I give him a statement. And after I got off the phone with him, I sent a text to Derek, Nathan, and Salt. I did that because he only gave me 20 minutes to get back to him, and I need to hear from all three of them quickly. And I told them what the circumstances were. I told them what the moral issue is that he wanted us to comment on, and asked what they thought about me giving the comment on this. I did not tell them where I stood on it because I did not want to affect where they were going to stand. I didn't want to affect their answer. Without exception, every one of them replied and said, do not give a statement. Without exception. And they had not consulted one another. All three of them, independent of one another, said, do not give a statement on this. And then every one of them gave the same appendix to that. They said, because we do not want to be known as the anti-church. In other words, we don't want to be known as the church that has picked this particular moral issue, and everything that we are and everything that we do is intended to address this specific moral issue. The way Derek put it was, he says, I would much rather people accuse us of making disciples than for them to accuse us of delivering people from this specific sin. That is especially important because at the time, we were only 6 months old. And so whatever tracks you lay early on end up being the ones that you're being forced into long term. That was the response from every one of them. So I called him back and said that we don't have a comment to give. He was a little disappointed in that, made a point to voice that disappointment. Didn't matter to me because I live a life of disappointing people. And then I took that moment and learned from it. 2 months ago, I get another phone call from a person who I do not know. Have never met this person. And he asked if he can have coffee with me. So we meet at the coffee spot right here on the corner, 27th and Welton. I'm sitting down, and he tells me that he's planning this event where there's going to be, he intentionally avoided using the word protest. I want to say that out loud. In his defense, the two things I want you to say about me, about I want you to hear me say about him in affirmation of him, he avoided the word protest, and he was very organized. And those two things just impressed me. They did. So he says, these things are three important issues I think that we need to address. I will tell you what these are. He said we need to take a stand on the biblical idea of marriage. He says we need to take a stand on the protecting of unborn life, and we need to take a stand on parental rights. Those are his three things. And so we're sitting down, and it's about 8 o'clock in the morning. So I only heard every fourth word he's saying, and he's walking me through this, and he has this PowerPoint presentation. He's breaking it down for me, all these details. Now, I'll say this. For the most part, I actually agreed with what he was saying. For the most part, I agree with what he was saying. He says, but this is what I think we should do. He says, I think that we should have this event where we set up a bunch of senior pastors in front of the Capitol building and then have a momentary display of unity on this issue. My two questions to him were, why only senior pastors? And what do you do the next day? Those are my only two questions for him. I said, why is it that you're only inviting this group, this specific office of Christians, and then what are we going to do the day after that moment, the day after that event? He gave me a relatively acceptable answer to the first question as to why he chose senior pastors. It wasn't adequate for me, but I could see how it would be enough for someone else. But then the answer he gave for the second one, what do we do the day after? He says, that's when my work really starts. I said, okay, that didn't answer my question. When you say your work starts the next day, what work will you be doing the day after the event? That was my issue here. And he gave me he responded. I say this a lot. He responded to my question, but he did not answer my question. So I take his response. I was asking him these questions and writing it all down because I knew I was going to take it back to Derek, Nathan, and Salt. And I knew where I stood on this issue, and I knew what I was going to fight for in the elder meeting. But when I go to them, didn't have to fight for it because when I presented it to them, they all said the same thing they'd said a year earlier. We shouldn't say anything, and we should not partake in this event. And the same reason, this whole setup has no ongoing plan for making disciples. We're not trying to make laws. We're trying to make disciples. Now, I will say that the one exception to that would be the abortion issue. Okay, I won't say that out loud. And I can tell you why I make that subtle distinction regarding the protecting of life. I think the state has the responsibility to protect life physically from harm. But I think that we have been so intentional to make laws regarding other moral issues that the church has gotten lazy. We made laws that resulted in behavior modification. And because it looks like God, we did not intentionally invest into the lives of people so that it could actually be of God. It looked godly, but the fact is, when you dive into it, people were only living this way because they were afraid of earthly legal consequences. When the fact is, you don't want for people to live a godly life out of fear of earthly legal consequences. You want for them to live their life because they have a deep-seated, heartfelt, overwhelming affection for the Christ who is King. We made laws instead of disciples. And the reason we're finding ourselves in an uproar now, and we're saying we're losing the country, my response to that is, we never had it. We had laws that gave us the impression that we had it. Whenever someone says to me, this is a Christian nation, my response to that is, really? What do you do with a couple centuries of slavery? How do you disregard Jim Crow laws and oppression out of the same people who are claiming this Christ that you're talking about? The Martin Luther King did a protest in Birmingham, and the pastors of they weren't breaking laws as in as in violating people. They were boycotting. They were deciding, we're not going to spend our money here. The clergyman of the city wrote him a letter saying, you're being disruptive in our city. And he had been arrested because of the peaceful protests. And he had to write a letter from a Birmingham jail entitled, Why We Can't Wait. They're saying to him, wait, this thing that you want will come. And he says, this is why we can't wait. That from the pastors. It didn't come from the journalists. It didn't come from the Klansmen. It didn't come from the police in the city. It came from the pastors in the city, the people who were the spokespeople of Christ. My question is, when did we have this Christian country that you refer to? We never had an actual surrendered, discipled, God-loving people. We had laws that made it look as so. And the fact is, we got so comfortable with people abiding by laws that we forgot that we're supposed to make an impact on their hearts. Now, here's where we are now. We're in a season now where everybody's in full complaint mode. And I will concede this point. There was a time when the church was the voice that sets culture. There was a time when that was true. And then we devolved from that. And we became one of the voices that sets culture. And then we devolved from that. And then we became the minority voice that sets culture. And we're not there anymore. We're the laughingstock. I don't necessarily recommend this because some of the language is out of control and he's annoying. But if there's a guy named Bill Maher who has a show on HBO. If you ever listen to Bill Maher speak about Christianity, he's not treating you as a minority voice. He's treating you as the laughingstock. You believe the myth, God created a man and a woman out of dust in a moment by simply speaking them into existence, and then that man and woman are the seed from whom every other person has come. That is absolutely ridiculous to him. That's ridiculous. It's much more reasonable for you to believe that the universe came into existence out of nothing. You guys are stupid. The world, one moment there was nothing, and then for reasons I cannot explain, the next moment, there was something. That makes much more sense than believing that there was a God who brought it into existence. That's his argument. And he has an audience that laughs at us with him. We're the laughingstock. Now, I want to say something that you all need to hear that you may not believe. If you do a survey of Americans, this is how they broke themselves down, okay? 25% of them identify themselves as non-Christians. 25%. I should say only 25% identify themselves as non-Christians. 75% self-identified as Christians. 75%. I'm getting these numbers from the Lifeway statistics system. There's a man named Ed Stetzer, who's the president of the Lifeway, the statistical arm of Lifeway, and it's a very reliable source, okay? 75% self-identify as Christians. Here's how Ed Stetzer breaks the 75% down, because at this point, you should be asking me, wait a minute, if 75% of the country is Christian, then how did we get here, okay? Now, this is how he breaks it down. He says that of the 75%, 25% of them are what he would call committed Christians. 25% are committed Christians. Another 25% are what he calls congregational Christians. Now, by that he means they show up for Christmas, Mother's Day, and Easter to sit in the congregation, okay? They're CME Christians. They show up three times a year: Christmas, Mother's Day, and Easter. That's why we were so full last week. And then the last one, you have what he calls casual, or a more appropriate word, he had to stick to the C because he's Baptist. A more appropriate word would be nominal Christians. And nominal simply means in name only. In name only. So they self-identify, but they don't hold to the doctrine. They don't identify with the church. They're not living in a community of people, okay? So you have 25% who say they're non-Christians. You have 25% that are committed, 25% that are congregational, and 25% that are nominal. Now, the question I want to answer is, how did we get here? Here's how this happened. We, as a way of life, managed the non-Christians and the nominal Christians by making laws. And then we committed ourselves to going after the congregational Christians. So here's how it works. Instead of living lives that engage them, we set up centers, buildings that have rock walls and gymnasiums and coffee shops. And we have these events on Sunday morning. And we say, join us on Sunday morning. Because the pastor is going to preach about Jesus and the Super Bowl. Or he's going to preach about the joys of being you and all about you. It'll be some self-centered, man-focused, watered-down idea of the message so that more people will want to come. That's our attempt to get the congregational ones, the ones who have shown a willingness to sit in the room occasionally. That's what we're going after. We go after them really hard, and then we have these bad words for the nominal Christians and the non-Christians. So the idea that I had when I'm having this conversation with this gentleman at Coffee at the Point regarding this event that's not a protest at the Capitol is, isn't this just erecting a wall between us and the nominal Christians and the non-Christians who we're supposed to be discipling? You're so fixated on making laws that will manage, that will control their behavior, that you're not intending to affect their hearts in such a way where they want to live a life that glorifies God instead of doing it out of a fear of laws and consequences that we may impose upon them. We're putting up a wall. We're not living a life that pursues. We're saying either stay there or come join us. That's how we do it. It's a matter of inviting people into the room where we are so they can hear our message, or we shun them from afar. I do not like using names much, okay? But this is one of the times I actually do like it, but my wife's in the room. And she doesn't like it, okay? But I have to do it now. The person who comes to mind for me in this issue regularly is Pat Robertson. I sit there and watched him on television make a comment regarding homosexuals who are in California with a ring with a needle in it going around, HIV positive homosexuals, and they're shaking people's hands so they can infect them. And I'm sitting there watching this, yelling at the television, who told you that? Who told you that? No wonder you've lost credibility. Even if 100 people do that, if 100 out of millions are doing it, and you've categorized millions of people, then you have erected a wall so that the remaining 999,000, whatever it is, will not hear a word you have to say because you've relegated them to this stupid category. He is horrible at that. He's the same one that said that Katrina hit New Orleans because of debauchery there. Why haven't we had a hurricane in Denver? We're just as debauched as New Orleans. This is not the center of holiness. Are you kidding me? Please, wait, I'm just waiting for a flood of snow to come get us. How did you decide that? He speaks up in a manner that erects a wall. Now, some people are going to hear what I'm saying, and they're going to jump to the extreme and accuse me of it and say, he should affirm sin. Why are those my two options? Either affirm it or shut them down and don't speak to them. Those are my options. That's what I have. Either put up a wall or say what you're doing is okay. Those are not the two options. Both of them are wrong. My goal in life is to stand between two extremes and say out loud, both of you are wrong. I guarantee that's what heaven's going to be like. Guarantee it. Jesus is going to stand in the crowd. Everyone's going to go to their different sides. The Calvinists are going to be over here, and the Arminians are going to be over here. I'm going to be on this side, okay? And Jesus is going to stand between the two of us and say, both of you are wrong. Both of you. Egalitarians over here, and the complementarians over here. This whole, we're going to have years and years of arguments about what women can and cannot do in the church. And Jesus is going to stand up in the middle and say, both of you are wrong. Both of you. The people who found me, found the empty tomb after I got up, were women. Both of you got this wrong. That's going to be what there's some conjecture here, but I'm pretty sure that's what heaven's going to be like. Because we have everything as black and white in our minds. We never think that the thing that we're passionate about could be the extreme end of the spectrum. If I'm over here, then everyone else is wrong. There's this thing that none of you care about right now, but there's this debate regarding the new and old perspectives on Paul. And there's this thing going on between John Piper and N.T. Wright. And then these two men are friendly with one another. They're great. They're writing books. They're cordial. They let each other read the book before they publish it. Each of them writes a response to the book. All of their disciples broke up into camps, and they hate each other. And we're going to get to heaven, and God's going to say, both of you are wrong. You are representing me out of your preferences. It's not a matter of extremes. I don't have to say it's either right or reject you. There's a middle ground where I'm saying, I don't agree with this, and here's why. I think it's wrong, but let me love on you. Why can't I do both? Now, what does that have to do with the passage? Look at Luke 19. Verse 1. He entered Jericho, he being Jesus, and was passing through. Now, you know this because a couple weeks ago, you remember that he said he was on his way to Jerusalem. He stops off in Samaria to see if he can find somewhere to stay on the way there. So the moment this whole process that we've been reading for the past four chapters has been him on his way to Jerusalem. In fact, if you look at verse 28 of chapter 19, you have what we call the triumphal entry. That's when he comes into the city and he's on the foal of a donkey and people are waving the palm branches. That's his entrance into Jerusalem. This whole process for the past four chapters has been him going to Jerusalem because he intends to publicly proclaim the kingdom of God. He has a different understanding of it than the people who are there waiting for him, but he's going there to proclaim the kingdom. He stopped in Samaria. They did not have anything to do with him. Now he's passing through Jericho because it's on the way to Jerusalem. The passage says in verse 1, he entered Jericho and was passing through, and there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. Now, I want you to know this about verse 2. It's redundant. He's telling you something that you should know from the first point, and in case you missed it, he gives it to you explicitly. Pastor Derek covered this briefly last week. Israel was under the oppression of Rome. They were a province of Rome. Rome did not come in and tell them that you are not allowed to practice your religious commitments here in Israel. They didn't take any of that from them. They let them keep their temple until they concluded that the temple was a means of assault, and so they destroyed it in 70 AD. But at this point, they still let them go through their practices. They still had the Pharisees, and there were rabbinic roles there. They let them do all of those things. But the only thing is, because we are over you, you have to pay taxes to us. In a very divisive act, they would hire Jewish men to be the collectors of the taxes. They would hire Jewish men to be the collectors of the taxes. In fact, one of the reasons Matthew, the gospel writer and the apostle, one of the reasons he was frowned upon from people who are outside the camp was Matthew was a tax collector. If you read Matthew chapter 16, when Jesus is going through, Matthew chapter 18, when Jesus is going through how one handles rebellion or sin, he says, first you go to them and address their sin. If they don't listen, then you take a couple witnesses with you and address their sin. If they don't listen to that, then you take it before the church. If they don't listen to the church, then you are to cast them out and treat them as a tax collector. That's him recognizing that in this culture, tax collectors were despised. Why? Rome didn't pay the tax collector. They would hire him, and he would work on commission. So basically, he would charge the taxes, and he could set whatever the tax was. So if Rome comes to him and says, we want, I'm going to use contemporary dollars now, we want for you to give us $500,000 in taxes. He did not systematically go around and charging people in a manner that would allow him to get $500,000. He would go around and charge them in a manner that would result in him having $1 million. And then he would give Rome their $500,000, and then he would keep the balance. He would overcharge them so that after paying Rome, he could have a profit. In this city, Zacchaeus was the chief tax collector, meaning he had tax collectors who were paying him a piece of what they were making. They were breaking him off. So when Luke tells you that Zacchaeus was the chief tax collector, that's all he had to say. But he says, for those of you who may be missing the point, he was rich. He knows that Jesus is coming through the city. He knows he's coming through Jericho. Verse 3, and he was seeking to see who Jesus was. But on account of the crowd, he could not because he was small of stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. So there's a couple things, there's some cultural stuff you have to hold on to, okay? I just told you the situation with the tax collector. You have to read it from the perspective of the first century Jewish person. They despised tax collectors because the tax collectors were robbing them while representing Rome. The other thing you need to know is whenever you have a meal with someone in this culture, it was an affirmation of the person. Not necessarily an affirmation of their actions, but it was an affirmation of the person. There was an intimacy. There was a community there. It was a communing. It is not an accident that when we have missional community gatherings, we require that you have meals together. And that those meals be intentional and corporate. Everyone brings something. You're investing into the corporate meal. Because when you sit down and you eat with people, there's a knitting together. There's an intimacy that grows out of that. There's a closeness that comes from that. And so we intentionally emphasize that because we have derived that from the first century idea. He says to him, Zacchaeus, come down out of the tree. Now, I don't have time. But there's so much funny stuff happening here. You have a little guy who can't see Jesus, and so he climbs a tree. Now, Pastor Derek told you this last week when he was talking about the father and with the prodigal son. Remember, he sees his son on the horizon, and it says that he lifted up his robe and ran to him, and that was inappropriate in Jewish culture. It was just as inappropriate for a grown man to climb a tree. He humiliated himself so that he could get a glimpse of the master. He had no concerns about what people thought about him. He said, Jesus is coming. I gotta see him. So he climbed a tree, grown man. Jesus walks by, sees him in the tree, knowing that it's humiliating for a grown man to be up in a tree. What does he do? He brings attention to the fact that this grown man is in the tree. You, Zacchaeus, 1334 Elm Road. Your wife's name's Rebecca, and I know she can cook off the chain. I'm staying at your house today. So come down from that tree. Everybody step back so that Zacchaeus can come down out of his tree. And everyone in the room, everyone in the crowd is clamoring. So Zacchaeus climbed a tree? Now you have to understand this. Everybody in the city knows who Zacchaeus is. He's the chief tax collector. How many of you have heard of the IRS? Yes, if you haven't, then you might go to jail because you got some debts. Yes, Zacchaeus is the IRS. They've heard of him. They know who he is. They know his role. They're interested in the fact that he climbed a tree. They know what he does. They know that he robs. And Jesus says, I'm eating at your house. The response to that was, this Jesus that everyone was happy to see, he's eating in the home of a sinner. Now, because of the shortness of time, I need to just jump straight to the point here. In the discussion I mentioned earlier about the 25% that are non-Christian and then the 75% that are, and then 25% of them are committed and 25% are nominal and 25% are congregational, Zacchaeus is the non. And let me tell you what he did not do. He did not say, "Hey, Zacchaeus, I'm preaching Isaiah 61 on Sunday. Come hear me preach it." He didn't do that. He didn't say, "Hey, we're having a block party. And when we had this block party, you can collect everybody's taxes at the same time. Show up for the block party." That's not what he did. He didn't appeal to the specifics of his need. Now, don't leave it thinking Brandon said block parties are bad and lock-ins and what other corny stuff do we do? Awanas and stuff like that. Like, don't leave her thinking that Brandon's saying it's bad. I'm saying to you, we treat that as the thing instead of a thing. I'm not saying that you should only be missional in that you're going out. I'd have no problem with attractional. My problem with attractional is that we treat it as though it's the only way to do it. You invite people to where we are, that's fine. We do that. We ask you to do that for anniversary. We ask you to do that for Easter. We ask you to do that for Christmas. We have moments when we do that. But it's more important to us that you get up and go to them than it is for you to invite them to us. Jesus did not say, "Come to synagogue on Sunday because I'm going to be spitting that hot fire." That's not what he said. He says, "No, I'm coming to your house and we're going to have a meal. You're going to entertain me. I'm going to sleep in your home." Everyone knew what that meant. This is a moment where he is engaging this man, this unlawful sinner, this rebeller, this person who despises the God we worship, this person who is active in the oppression of his own people. He's robbing us for the oppressing Rome. And Jesus is going to eat in his home. He must be just as guilty as Zacchaeus. I want you to catch this. Jesus did not care what they thought about his action. He went anyway. Look at the fruit. Verse 7. "And when they saw it, they all grumbled. He has gone to be the guest of this man who is a sinner." And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold." Now here's what happens. Zacchaeus has been, appreciate this. Zacchaeus has been an outcast for as long as he has been the tax collector. Everyone treats him horribly. And then the man who raises dead people shows up and says, "I'm going to eat at your house." His response to that was, "You're going to eat at my house? You're not going to shun me the way everyone else has?" He comes down out of the tree and says, "Everybody I've robbed, I'm paying them back. If I've misrepresented the financial makeup of anyone, I'm paying it back four times over." He exceeded the law. He didn't simply do the Jewish responsibility of paying them back. He exceeded the law. He gave it back to them fourfold. His response to compassion in the presence of a person who could legitimately judge his sin, his response was, "I want to follow you. I want to do what makes you happy. You don't have to put legal systems in place. My affection to and from you has resulted in me deciding that I want to give my entire life to you." Jesus went after the 25%. Instead of erecting a wall that says, "I tell you what, if you're not going to be of us, then we're going to throw grenades over the wall," he climbed the wall and said, "Come and be in community with me." How many of us willingly give our lives away like that? How many of us set our doctrinal preferences aside? And you need to hear me say this. Before I move on to preach at the weight, I'm the doctrinal guy, okay? I'm the doctrinal guy. I will fight over the hypostatic union. I'm that guy. I'm that guy. But my goal in life is for you to know that I love you more than I love the doctrine of baptism. I love you more than I love the fine-tuned details of the incarnation. I'm not compromising on those things, but But am I going to club you over the head in such a way where you don't have anything to do with me and don't hear what I have to say going forward? He went after the 25. Now, I've been subtle enough. Now my typical brash self for just a minute, literally 60 seconds. You know where I stand on marriage. You know where I stand on that. For those of you who don't, a man, one man, marries one woman. Okay? I have to say that, by the way, because I believe that the plurality issue is what's next. That's what's next. That's where we're headed. Just so you know, get ready for it. One man marries one woman. I'm no longer the minority voice on that issue. I'm the voice of darkness. The consistent statement regarding the draft this past week is the word enlightenment. The NFL is now enlightened. That's where we are. We're enlightened now. The implication of that is if you don't think that way, then you are, what's the opposite of enlightened? Endarkened. Okay? So I'm endarkened on this issue. Okay? I'm dated. I'm expired. I'm back there. And I'm telling you the biblical idea, one man marries one woman for the sake of illustrating the one Christ and the one church in their marital relationship. That's why we are in this situation. Does that mean that my responsibility now is to stand firm on that issue and throw grenades over the enlightened ones so that they will no longer have a conversation with me on issues of this sort? Does this mean that I set up camp with 100 pastors at the Capitol building and we have this protest that will inevitably be on television? And as a result of us doing that, now everyone who sees me there is saying, I want absolutely nothing to do with the dialogue with him because he has made it clear to me that he wants me to either be entirely of him or be removed from him. I'm saying to you that the manner in which we have done this is intentionally designed to shun the 25. To shun the 25% who are the non-Christians and to mock those who are nominal Christians. And we only invite those who are casual Christians, the congregational people. And all that does is result in church transfer instead of actual disciple making. And so when I sit down with people and they tell me how great they're doing. We grew by 7,000 people in June. And I say, yes, but that's because a 7,000 member church down the street shut down. Everyone moved from one building to the next. What about the dying people in the neighborhood where you are? If you want to boast about something, then boast about the fact that you gave your life away for people who want absolutely nothing to do with the message that you have. We got to go after the 25. Which means your house has to stop being your house. You give yourself away. You give your home away. You give your food away. You give your money away. Just a few verses before this, a few chapters before this one, in chapter 15, Jesus says, if anyone is to be my disciple, he has to hate his mother and his father and his children, nay, even himself. Does he mean you actually hate your mother and father? No. No. The same Bible says, honor thy mother and father. Okay? Use some literary appreciation here. He's saying that your love for him should be so grand that it makes your love for your mother look like hate. In comparison, he knows you love your mother greatly. He's saying, take the standard of loving your mother. Everyone does that greatly. Now, the love you have for me should be so grand that it makes that love look like hate in comparison. That's how much he's first. That's how much he is first. That is how much he is first. So when you say to me, Brandon, I really don't think that this whole regular interacting with people in the church where we are, where we're going to sit down and have these meals together and have this fellowship, I don't really have time for that. That's not my inclination. I'm not wired that way. I wasn't raised like that. That's not how we do it where I'm from. Listen to me. Miss me with that. I'm not calling you to live out what you do comfortably. Discipleship is often, by definition, often uncomfortable. And that means you have to go after a tax collector who everybody hates, who has embarrassed himself up in a tree. then you go get him. Let's pray. Lord, we bless you for what you are about to do in and through us. But first, God, move us out of your way. Let our preferences, our biases, our